much as
my life.
Are you
still
not well, Mark?
Yeah, it's kind of coming and going. Like
I didn't ask about your sex life. I said, hey! How are you feeling?
Physically, I feel all right.
Yeah, but I'm not asking about your sex life. Hey! Hey, Richie, this is the show.
This is it. This is the show.
Is it keeping you up at night?
No, I'm asking about his cold, actually. Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a
bad case of loving you. Hello and welcome to I Hate Doctor Who, the only Doctor Who podcast that Toby Haydock won't do.
He's not done mine yet, but only because I haven't asked him.
Has he not?
No, I haven't asked him, to be fair. But I'm sure he would. Wouldn't do this shit.
I was about to say, if you'll do the Polis box, then.
He's fast becoming the Miriam Margolis of Doctor Who podcasts.
I've never seen him eat a raw onion.
For anyone that hasn't listened to the podcast before, sorry about this being your first episode, but the concept is that I, a Doctor Who fan, take people who don't like Doctor Who or who are unfamiliar with Doctor Who, and I choose an episode for them. Now, today, to switch up the format, I've decided to invite on three members of Doctor Who podcast royalty to take me through my first viewing of a blank spot in my Doctor Who viewing experience. So I'll just go through everyone one by one. First of all, we have from Doctor Who Too Hot for TV, Dylan Rees. Hello.
Hello. It's wonderful to be here. Also, can I just say, you're not a real fan if you haven't seen it all. Like, you've been telling everybody you're the expert, but you're not. You're getting kicked out of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society.
Yeah, the podcast is over now once they know my secret. Joining Dylan, long-time listeners all recognise Mark Donaldson from On the Timelash. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Mark used to contribute in the early days, when I was a wee bit more organised.
Oh, yeah, Ben and I used to, basically, we were the actual experts, because we would basically go, has Richie made the right decision here, or has he fucking shat the bed? And generally, we were like, no, he's made a good decision, and that's why he got rid of us, because there's no point in having somebody agree with him. That's the point of the podcast.
Also, again, I'm just really poorly organised. But, Mark, thank you for coming on. And also joining us from Mikey and Who, legitimate character actor, Mikey Smith.
Hello, hello, Richie.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me? I
had a short-lived podcast, very popular, short-lived podcast series about the Shuti Gatwa series, but I became disenfranchised, much like Shuti Gatwa himself, and went off the whole thing, much like Shuti Gatwa himself.
How far did you make it?
Five episodes.
Mikey, are you the only person in this chat that didn't go to a cinema at midnight to watch Empire of Death?
Mate, come on.
I didn't do that either.
Okay.
I was too disenfranchised by that point as well. Yeah. I was like, I'm not giving them my money.
We all went outside to smell the grass, and unfortunately, a dog had done a big shit on it first. Much like Shuti Gatwa. No, that one doesn't work.
Well, guys, thank you for joining me. So, yeah, today we're going to look at the Pertwee story, Invasion of the Dinosaurs. Now, I just want to defend myself here slightly.
Yeah.
And that...
As well as I should.
I want to defend myself slightly and say that, like, obviously, you know, when you're watching Doctor Who, nobody ever watches it in order. So you're always making a decision. And sometimes you just never make the decision to watch a particular story. And
I want to dig into this. Because it's got the reputation as, oh, it's the one with the shit dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Was that like in the back of your head as you kind of kept...
That's basically it. I just never got... It was like how I took ages to watch Kinda as well, which was an obvious mistake.
The one with the shit snake.
And I think, I don't know, somewhere along the line, this idea got into my head that the one with the shit dinosaurs was just shit, which we'll delve into in a minute.
Well, wait a minute. Surely you're watching 30 Years in the TARDIS and you see the clips from Invasion of the Dinosaurs, and you think, "Oh, that looks fun. I'll watch that."
This is
that's
a,
how we got. This in, is, if you're about to say you haven't watched 30 Years in the TARDIS,
we'll be back here for the anniversary.
I have a question. How many holes have you got? If that isn't too personal,
I've still got a few. I mean, I'm going to be honest. There's quite a few Hartnell holes.
Oh,
and I've not and missing episodes. I've just not.
But the thing is, there are certain ones you don't have to watch to be a fan that are admissible, like all of Patrick Troughton, for example.
Oh, are you,
right? There are certain ones. But you don't miss a Pertwee.
Yeah. I know. Look, like I said...
Is it because it's just too woke, that era? Because there's always a message at the heart of it.
Well, again, we'll cover this later. But no, it's literally just... I just never... Like I said, every time you watch an episode, you're making a choice. It's not like I'm sitting watching them in sequence. I've never sat.
How many times have you
sequence.
Seen Shada, just out of interest?
Oh, I haven't even finished Shada.
Oh, okay, that's all right then. That's
so don't worry.
Or is it? I don't know.
Have you watched 30 Years in the TARDIS?
I haven't watched 30 Years in the TARDIS.
So you've never seen Carol Ann Ford pull a young boy into a TARDIS?
No.
You don't even know what a middle-aged Roberta Tovey looks like.
No, I don't.
So you've never seen John Pertwee hanging about on the South Bank?
You've never heard Toya Wilcox explain why Cybermen costumes are a bit like S&M and sexy?
My God. I mean, you're selling to me.
Do you know,
have you never seen Nicholas Courtney in the back of an Uber?
So you don't even know Mike Gatting's opinion on Doctor Who?
Richie, are you a cunt?
I'll let Mark revive himself.
Sorry.
I might be.
For listeners, if he kept that horrendous cough in, I'm just coming down from a bit of a cold, so this is very risky because I'm with three very funny people, so I may die.
You know, this sounds like every other thing, the notes you're giving, like, sounds like every other kind of shit, as opposed to magic and dreams.
Everyone who listens to the podcast ends up on the podcast eventually, so...
That is how podcasting works, I believe, yes.
Yeah. Like, I'm quite new to Doctor Who conventions as well, thanks to you guys. But it's funny when you go to the pub with a bunch of people and you're like, oh, you've all got podcasts. Yeah. We're all just, everyone's just introducing themselves by their podcast name.
Now, here's a man ahead of his time.
Good grief, it's a stegosaurus.
Long before it was fashionable, the Doctor was walking with dinosaurs and driving under dinosaurs.
Hang on to your hat, yeah.
And blowing up dinosaurs and mopping down dinosaurs.
Keep back!
Doctor Who and the Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
It will stay asleep, won't it, Doctor?
Yeah, right. Starts tonight at 9 and continues through the week on BBC Choice, a digital channel from the BBC.
So, yeah, so Invasion of the Dinosaurs... I'll just do some quick stats. Season 11. It's the second story in season 11?
Yes.
I think it is. Yeah. It's right after the Time Warrior. Broadcast 12th of January 1974 to the 16th of February. Also 1974, obviously. It's John Pertwee and Liz Sladen. New fresh-faced Liz Sladen. Like I said, I just... never made the decision to watch it, and the only thing I knew about it was, as you said, shit dinosaurs, which I had seen. Also, I thought it was in black. I thought like a lot of it was lost to black and white, but it seems to be only one, right?
It's just the first episode because it was called Invasion. So this was the idea that if they called it Invasion of the Dinosaurs, people they thought, oh, well, we'd ruin the surprise of the shit dinosaurs. We'll start the shit dinosaurs, I think, because I think the whole...
Okay.
I would like to talk about the shit dinosaurs in a second, because I'd like to put the defence of that. I don't think it's true.
Look,
you're on a roll, Mark. I don't want to interrupt.
But you have.
You do your... And then I'm coming in.
Anyway, so it was called... Paddy Russell, the director, decided to call it first episode Invasion. Mm-hmm. To kind of keep the surprise, which annoyed Malcolm Hulk, and there was a whole big furore about that. But as a result, because it was called Invasion, it was kind of junked along with the Patrick Troughton cereal. Is that not true?
That's not true. That
I can't believe I get that far into that obvious bullshit that he's gleaned from a convention.
Oh, this is like being on QI.
Go on, I'll let you take this, Dylan.
No, I can't remember why it is. I just know that that's false.
All right, hang on. I've got to turn this wiki up.
Oh, sure,
yeah. It'll be in the myths section.
So while Mark looks that up, just as the guardians of Doctor Who fandom that I have here, generally, how is Invasion of the Dinosaurs? How do you think it's seen generally by fandom?
I think people generally like it, don't they?
I think it had a rep before it was available on home video that it was rubbish. And then it came out on home video, and it also had a book in the sort of 70s that people and the 80s that people seemed to like. And they were like, well, we can forgive so much other things. We can forgive the dinosaurs. And so I think it's been held in high regard for many years now.
Yeah. And the book famously has a really unique cover with like a Batman ka-clang on it or something, doesn't it?
Ka-clack. Get out of the fucking podcast. Everybody knows that. On the subject of the invasion, though, you are absolutely right. It is a myth. But it's only a myth because there's no evidence to suggest that that's why it was wiped. But basically, all the tapes for the invasion were wiped in 1972, which was more than 2 years before Invasion of the Dinosaurs was transmitted.
That's all I was going to say, Mark, because, you know, I'm a big fan. Is that it was all junk. It was all junked, and they only managed to get five back in colour. Well, five NTSC to convert the others to colour, and they were all in black and white. You know that and then they've then subsequently restored that first one, which is no more or less valid than the NTSC conversion. So the purists could argue that it only exists in black and white to this day.
I was thinking when I was watching it, like, I think the Blu-rays should have a black and white option.
Absolutely, as that's the pure version.
No, you mean just of everything?
I guess I could just turn the saturation down on my TV.
This is how it looked for the majority of the British public in the 1970s who couldn't afford colour televisions.
Yeah.
Can we talk about Vidfire? Oh, sorry.
No, you're on the wrong podcast. You're on the wrong podcast. People aren't here for Vidfire.
No, I've heard that Richie cultivates a young female audience, and they might be interested in the mid-90s short-lived technological advancement of Vidfire.
I feel there's some strong opinions about Vidfire coming.
Well, I'm just going to say, people go on about stuff being colourised, like that's a big moment. I actually think Vidfire was a big moment.
I mean, Vidfire is impressive.
Yeah, that Vidfire turns it from being not what it was like when it went out to more like what it was like. And I think the insertion of the additional frames makes it much more... What are you laughing at? What, someone's telling you some actual things? Not just some crap they picked up from Katie Manning at a convention 7 years ago? Mark?
I'm sorry, continue. We are all the exact people that when their partners go away on holiday are sitting at fucking 2 a.m. watching little featurettes about NTSC conversion with a whiskey in their hand.
Would you like me to get off the topic of Vidfire? Because I have lots more to say.
A part of me wants to know where you're going with this.
I'm not going anywhere.
You just want to say that Vidfire is brilliant.
I'm just saying that when we got all that stuff that had, you know, 24 frames per second because it was effectively film, it made everything look like film. And film is more distancing from the fiction, right?
I see.
Whereas it went out on video, which was, you know, 50, 60 frames. Yeah. Which is more like what people used on their home video camera and feels more real. And therefore, when you were watching, you know, when you were watching the invasion of the dinosaur, the internal stuff had that urgent, real feel about it. And the switch over to exterior was more jarring and more part of the sensations of watching the program. So all I'm saying is that when they got all that stuff back for the invasion of the dinosaurs, which was lost, it all came back in film. And so they had to Vidfire the internal stuff, but no one talks about that.
Yeah. No, because, I mean, for listeners who obviously aren't fucking Doctor Who nerds, because this isn't the podcast for that. But yeah, the classic episodes went out to the colonies and the, you know...
You can't call them colonies anymore, Mark.
Well, I could at the time. former
all right,
colonies,
Colonel Sanders. You can't speak like this.
But they went out on 60mm film. They didn't go out on videotape.
I feel like I might need to grab the reins.
It was the Commonwealth, right?
Yeah, that too.
Now, let's get on to bicycling. Anybody know about bicycling systems for episodes around the world? This is what your listeners want to know.
What's... Sorry. Oh, I do. I see, the problem is I want to know what you're talking about, but I
can't. Yeah, I do as well.
So, when the BBC sold... You can cut this. When they sold something to, I don't know, say Denmark would pay the full price for it, but... to subsidise poorer countries like Africa, those prints would then be bicycled on at a reduced rate to Africa where they could be screened.
Ah, that's why all the prints turn up in places like Nigeria.
Yeah, exactly. That's their final resting place.
So are they actual bicycles?
I don't think it's some guy cycling through Europe to Africa.
I like the idea of the actually now... You're never going to see Marco Polo again. But I tell you what, there's a guy somewhere in Africa who got some fucking good bike rims. You know? He just fitted a couple of film cans to his fucking bike and off he went. New wheels.
Oh, my God. Marco Polo just trailing down the road.
Doesn't Marco Polo just look like really boring to everyone?
It's the Holy Grail, Mikey. It's the Holy... Anyway, this isn't interesting.
So I think we've got about 2 minutes of usable content at the moment.
Good grief. It's a Stegosaurus. Oh, a splendid specimen. No, no, don't shoot. I want to take a good look at it.
Be careful, Doctor.
Don't worry, Brigadier. It's a vegetarian.
Yeah, but bring it back to the book thing. I did think watching it, like, I bet this is an incredible target. Just because it feels like such a dense story, but it's also... Yeah. I do know what's weird about it as well is it feels so different. Like, I think what was weird about me jumping into it, especially having watched Pertwee stuff so many times and then jumping into this episode and being like, this feels like a weird, very different kind of... Like, it's set in that school and it's like... There's just lots of weird stuff going on. And then obviously, Mike Yates being a fucking traitor as well. It's just...
Well, he's always been a wrong one, hasn't he? But you're right, it's like actual drama, isn't it, Mark? It's like actual...
Well, it is, but also I think it's really loose as well. Like, I think Pertwee's just... He's checked out, but in a good way. Mm. Like, it's not like he's going, oh, I'm not going to be Doctor Who at the end of the series, I'm going to just phone it in. He's just a lot more kind of... fun and charming and just a bit silly, like the bit in episode one where like he's posing for his kind of mugshot.
Yes.
And that bit was like, all right, one of us all together. Like all those little moments and stuff like that. He's just absolutely loving that. Like he just seems to be having such a great time. And Gorn is the kind of slightly you get flashes of it, like when he slags off the general in the first episode and stuff like that. Like the kind of the third Doctor you know and love, but he seems a lot more kind of just laid back.
Yeah, I think. Do you think it's because this is him traveling with Sarah Jane Smith, played by Liz Sladen, and that's a bit more. Like previously, he's been traveling with Joe Grant, who feels like a little kid. Where this feels like feels like a young woman. She looks like one of the likely lads or something like that. But it's just sort of, it's a different relationship, isn't it?
It is
quite different.
Sarah does most of the heavy lifting in this story,
which I'd
completely forgotten until watching it this week. Episode 6, all the Doctor really does is just flick a switch. It's her that kind of like convinces everybody to rise up against the guys. But we'll get to all that kind of, I guess, in the main.
That's what I mean. It's like a real drama. It doesn't follow like the formula. And I think it gets off to a good start because that first episode is so clever.
It's in black and white.
And it's in black and white. But it's also just so clever. It's like I could watch them walking around that, walking from bus stops and...
Yeah. Oh my god, the bus stop, the bit, one of my, I never realised this before, But when they're like, oh, we've got to get to Unit HQ. How are we going to get to Unit HQ? We don't have Bessie. We can't just get in the TARDIS because it's a bit, you know, unpredictable. And Sarah Jane's like, well, we could get a bus. The look on Pertwee's face, you know, to be like, Doctor Who doesn't get on the fucking bus. Jeez, look at me. Look at how I'm dressed. Do you think I get the bus?
I find that very relatable. Yeah. I didn't like get buses until I moved to where I live now. It's 25 minutes walk to the tube. I want to get a fucking bus.
I know. It's a bit like saying that to my girlfriend on the end of a night out.
Good night, bus. No, get a fucking Uber.
Absolutely not. It was fun going into this one mostly blind. There was a couple of things I knew about it, but Invasion
so
of
you
the
didn't
Dinosaurs,
know the sort of Mike Yates?
I knew the Mike Yates thing, which is a shame, because that would have been cool. But I didn't really know why the dinosaurs were there or anything about the organization that Yates was working for or what they're, you know. So it was a very, for that first episode and also looking at it and going, ah, shit, this is six episodes. This is going to be, you know, and it's like the first cliffhanger, I'm going to see a dinosaur and then, which is not what happened.
No.
But, so, Sarah Jane, the Doctor arrive, empty London.
Did you like all that stuff? I think that stuff is amazing. Yeah. It's like watching The Survivors or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's very atmospheric. There's a party that's like, was it like, I'm looking at it going, is this just 4 a.m. filming?
It was,
happening?
Yeah.
Is it?
It was. But they kind of did it. The story goes, I'm sure Mikey will punch holes in this anecdote.
I'm on standby.
But Paddy Russell's story is that basically the BBC would charge you a hefty overtime fee if you tried to sort of do official filming at 4 a.m.
Right.
So she and her DOP just went out in London at sort of 4 a.m. and shot some footage. Because it is quite alien to see London that
so quiet.
Even now, like, you go out in London at 4 a.m. now, I'm told.
Nah, yeah.
It's still quite busy.
But yeah, no, that was very, like, I loved all that stuff. But also, it was weirdly like, again, it comes back to that writing family entertainment in the 70s was a bit different because it was like the stuff for the looters.
Yeah.
But also the corpse and the car crash.
That's brutal.
Was so grim.
Yeah, that whole first episode, it's like, have you ever seen the BBC's Day of the Triffids?
Yeah.
That, you know, it's such a, it's so long until you see the Triffids. Exactly the same here. It's so long until you see the dinosaurs. It's just emptiness that slowly gets filled with stuff.
It's also the thing that on, like, now we're so used to, if there's an apocalypse, there is abandoned cars and something on fire.
Yeah.
And here, at first, it could just be early morning London. And then there's great use of demolished buildings, which could just be demolished buildings or something more sinister. And then when you do get to, like, the looters and there's blood on one of their faces and things like that. And so it sets it up really well. And especially if you're watching the black and white version, it's even more atmospheric. But then at a certain point, it does turn into the Chewitz advert from the 80s.
the Chewitz advert was the very first thing I thought of. Yeah, all that stuff is great. I also, for some reason, I've written milk float. I think I'm just enjoying, I think I'm just enjoying a snapshot, like a 70s snapshot. I think there's something about Doctor Who location filming, especially when it's set on Earth, that I'm just like, God, that looks like a nice day.
It's a proper, it is a proper time capsule, though. Watching the making of documentary of it today,
mm-hmm.
Matthew Sweets wandered around Trafalgar Square in, 2012.
Yeah,
and it's pretty quiet. Like, there's not many people around.
People were still happy then.
Yeah, people. 2012, and there was less tourists, I guess. Yeah. But I don't know. But it's like there's nobody there.
What's your problem with tourists, Mark?
Well, we'll get to that later. I just think they should all just be, you know,
they should go back to the colonies, right?
By turning us back to the Stone Age.
Richie, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
If they suddenly found another John Pertwee story that we didn't know about, and showed it to me, I would just be goosebumps central. Like, oh my God, it's another Pertwee. It's him doing other stuff. Did you have goosebumps watching it?
Oh my God, Mikey, I was, kicking myself through the entire thing, but also just so happy
that
I was watching a Because I genuinely was, I didn't know what to expect, but sitting down, I think, do you know what hit me? It was like, it just feels so big. It's got such a scale to it. And that's one thing I wanted to ask you, actually. I don't know if there's any chat around this, but like, the whole thing about calling the first episode Invasion instead of Invasion of the Dinosaurs and all that sort of stuff, there's something like, I don't know, it feels, maybe it's like stupid to even think of this as a concept at this point, but like an event episode, it was like, we got big giant dinosaurs wandering about the about London and...
Well, so Malcolm Hulk was one of the reasons he was really angry that they changed the title in episode one, was that he was like, that's the big selling point. Why would you hide that in the listings? Like, surely, like, dinosaurs in central London, kids are going to go nuts for that.
Yeah, it's massive. Massive
and because
idea.
The original pitch for this serial was that it was going to be like a satire on appeasement, which 30 years after the Second World War, weird time to do that. But basically the idea was that it was an alien race that made a deal with the Prime Minister to basically have London. And he's like, okay, fine, well, we can move everybody out of London, that's fine. And then they're like, now we want the southeast of England. And he's like, oh, I don't know about that. And they're like, now we want the whole fucking world, mate. And Barry Letts was like, yeah, sure, that's great, but, I mean, kids aren't really going to go for this, are they? No.
Yeah, they just want big old
dinosaurs.
They just want
big dinosaurs. And Hulk's like, oh, okay, right, I'll give you big dinosaurs.
But then also, to replace that, it's like, it's a mad cult.
Yeah, and then he kind of taps into that kind of cultish. But it's so, I think one of the reasons this is so great is that it's a direct, like it's a thematic sequel to The Green Death.
Yeah.
Which is like beloved by everybody. You've done it on this podcast, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's basically, it's Clifford Jones is the kind of young idealist who's like, no, there's a better way to do things. Mm-hmm. And in this, it's a bunch of sort of establishment figures who goes, nah, everything's fucked. People can't be trusted. We're going to just reverse everything and start again.
And also we then get Planet of the Spiders, which is then, if you like, the third in a trilogy.
Yeah, true.
I mean, it's fucking, it's sensational what goes on in this little tiny period.
The fact that Mike Yates is inspired to join Golden Age by the fact that he was undercover in this kind of like petrochemical company in the Green Death and was like,
yeah,
everything is awful, actually.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure I can go along with it.
It's so weird, like that sort of, it was funny watching this, is what I used to get excited about when I was a kid watching TV was continuity, which is obviously just something you don't care about anymore because it's just always happening. But anytime a story references an old story, you're like, holy fuck. But like this idea that Mike's been kind of almost radicalized by what happened in the Green Death is just such a cool
kind of thought. And is it?
As you know, Richie, from coming on my podcast, there is a comic strip that deals with Mike's journey into traitordom and idealism that can be found in the extended universe of Doctor Who.
Wait, is that in that Salamander one as well?
Yeah.
There's a scene where he talks about it, yeah.
And what's his bloody explanation for his outlandish behaviour?
Everything's fucked.
Yeah, basically.
It's relatable.
I mean, he's not wrong. I mean, if we're going to talk about how everything's fucked...
Well, luckily, Terence Dix addresses this issue in the commentary.
Yeah.
Oh, so I had a call with Mikey earlier, and he told me to watch the episode one commentary, but I said I didn't have the DVD. So.
the reason I wanted you, Terence Dix is on like doing this in episode maybe two or three. Mm-hmm. Episode one is, and the lads here will testify to this, is fun because it's Toby Haydock trying to get blood out of a fucking stone. and he bones into a solo interview with Paddy Russell as though he's just come off a Q&A with Colin Mapston. So he comes in with all this chummy postmodern energy and she's having none of it. And bless him, it's testament to the boy's skills. He keeps talking and he keeps asking and he gets nowhere. It is sensational. It is sensational listening. It really is. What do you lads think about it?
There's that moment where he's like, oh, so obviously you went on and you worked with Tom Baker, who I understand he was a bit tricky. Was he tricky? Was he a bit tricky? And she just sort of goes, yeah, I suppose, yeah, he was. I did find him difficult on the second one. That's it. That's all he gets. And he, and again, yeah, it's testament to him that he manages to fill that 25 minutes with something, because I think she says about 10 words.
God, like, what a grift, eh? Turning up to watch an old DVD and go, uh-huh, oh, look at that. Oh, I remember this. Do you want to elaborate? No.
He says to her, oh, you shouldn't have been out filming that, should you, first thing in the morning? Aye, there, Paddy. Hey, mate, matey, pal, matey. And she's like, well, I don't really want to talk about that.
Right. We'll need some rope and a strong net.
You intend to catch it?
Yes, of course. I want to observe it under laboratory conditions. Have you got any rope?
We've got some towing rope, sir.
You're going to tie it up?
That's my intention, yes.
All right, Corporal, carry on.
Right, sir.
That creature has an amiable disposition, Brigadier. And a brain about the size of a walnut.
While after chasing off a looter, we get our first dinosaur, which is a pterodactyl.
Yeah.
First incredible moment. Now, the thing that I love about the pterodactyl is not the model, but the sound of a man going, ah!
Do you remember those little, oh God, I can't remember what they were called, they were like little finger puppet things.
Yes, yeah. The jello ones. Little
rubber finger puppet, and it was like a little kind of crocodile mouth goblin thingy, and little spindly arms. That is what the pterodactyl in this reminds me of. It's just somebody with one of those, just in John Pertwee's face.
It looks to me like someone has skinned emu, like, especially when it's trying to get into the car. Because the thing is, I don't think this is a terrible effect. It's bad, no, but it's not terrible. And
but
I
it's
think
way worse than Doctor Who.
Yeah, and I think it's way worse in this story. But I think it's shot unsympathetically. I know she's trying to be quick with the shots, but it just needs to be cut quicker, and you could probably just about get away with
she
it.
She says that, doesn't she, in the documentary? She says that like she would have liked more studio time to kind of like work out how best to shoot the props that the sort of puppets they end up getting. And I mean, that's Doctor Who making of documentary 101. Not enough time. Yeah. There wasn't enough time to figure out how to shoot this thing sympathetically.
But the pterodactyl is how it's called, yeah, the little one, yeah? I actually think that's all right. I think the bit with the string puppet, you know, where it's flying?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
If she'd have sped that up, maybe. So if she'd have sped that up and been a lot closer
like
and a lot...
fucking Benny Hill pterodactyl.
No, but it's the exact speed that a pterodactyl would be if it was being operated by a bloke called Trevor, is the problem.
Yeah, okay.
So it just needs a little bit of fast, and some of the cutting around when it's coming through the window. I actually don't mind the pterodactyl. Can we talk about the dinosaurs just quickly?
Well, I was about to jump on at the dinosaurs, actually.
Okay,
so
I'm ready to jump on. Well, all I want to say is I actually think the reason why this story has a bad reputation for the dinosaurs is purely the T-Rex. I think all the rest are fine. It's the T-Rex, and it's especially that awful bit where they try and CSO some video footage of the T-Rex onto film. Now, in most other bits of footage, they've got small models on small sets. And I think that works really well. When you've got the dinosaur and you just sort of see him at the end and he's just kind of eating something, but it's clearly just a little model on a little set. I think that is fine. I think it's absolutely fine.
It's also the movement. Well, not so much the movement. It's when they kind of knock it out and it kind of falls to the ground. And it basically just looks like an empty glove puppet.
It's like one of those toys where you pull the trigger and it straightens up and then you let it go and it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, like when you're looking at the dinosaur, the mouth is a big part of why it looks shit. But I think there's a lot of really impressive like composite shots and stuff like that. But the thing I was going to say, especially when it comes to Doctor Who, is like I imagine when you're moving towards doing a quite ambitious setup that you probably haven't done anything like it before, and you've got no space to test it, and at some point you're just in production and you just have to keep going.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Barry Letts tells a really funny story in the documentary where he's like, yeah, so I went to the head of sort of visual effects and asked him if, like, you know, we want to do stop motion dinosaurs. And he was like, I mean, he doesn't do this in documentary, but he's like, yeah, I know a guy at Pinewood, mate. he could do your dinosaurs. He could do your dinosaurs. No worries. We'll get your dinosaurs. And we get what we get. I think one of the things that I think it should be lauded for, mm-hmm. is the model work, like, around it. The way they replicate those London streets, like, it's pretty decent.
It's really good.
I've got to disagree slightly, and I think I agree it's the T-Rex that is the big problem. Also, what's the one with the long neck?
The Brontosaurus. The Brontosaurus.
Yeah.
Well, it's when they fight each other, like, at the end of Jurassic Park. And it's like,
But later on, the one that's in the tube station and stuff looks really good.
Yeah, it does.
And again, the model work there looks really good. I think the problem is you've got these shoddy models, and then they are on what is clearly, like, your model train kit sort of model village. Mm. And I think that it just makes you unable to suspend
disbelief.
But the
model village, though, at least the model village has an attention to detail in terms of replicating what Pertwee stands in.
Have you not been to the model village at Babbacombe?
Yeah, and I trod all over it like those dinosaurs. And then the whole fucking thing. No, I want to... The Drashigs in the season before are, obviously, there is no frame of reference for a Drashig. It's just a monster that bursts out of the like a swamp, and it looks really cool shot on film. Mm-hmm. And I think because the background is more forgiving of that, I think they stick out less as being, essentially glove puppets.
I think they could have pulled off. So for listeners who aren't sort of major Doctor Who fans, the Drashigs are basically just like big kind of lizardy dragon things. And they were essentially a glove puppet that was just shot. And they look really good in terms of, because the shot's locked off. And it's literally all you see is just the sort of maw, like, opening and closing. And there's this, like, sort of great sound effect. And I think you could have done the T-Rex in that way to a certain extent.
You would have to build difficulties. A separate,
It gets into difficulties when you've got this sort of big fight in part six or whatever. But I think if you just had, like, a Drashig-style glove puppet for a T-Rex bearing down on John Pertwee and sort of Pertwee looking kind of terrified, I think you could have probably got away with it a bit more than they do.
Do you know what's weird? Is in Colony in Space, to represent a giant lizard creature, they take some footage of a lizard, don't they?
Yeah. Mm.
And that looks even shitter because it's obviously just off a... documentary or something.
Yeah, David Attenborough's offcuts.
And this is what's weird about consumers of this sort of fiction is that looks too real for us to think it's real.
Yeah.
We want it to not look real whilst looking real enough to be real enough. What is wrong with us?
Was it Ray Harryhausen who got lizards and strap things to them, like little sort of spikes and stuff like that?
I don't know. Harryhausen's the one that invented or refined stop motion techniques, which interestingly they don't use in any stop motion in this, but they do then use it in Terror of the Zygons, which is three years.
I mean, that still looks pretty shit as well.
Yeah. And that looks shit as well. Yeah. So what could we surmise from this conversation?
Doctor Who looks shit.
I mean, okay, this might be another one of Mikey's moments, but,
Mikey's moments.
Mikey's
is there
moments.
A jingle for that?
Sure, well, we'll see what I can do. But remember the chat in Web of Fear about how the council were like, we told you not to go into the underground.
Yeah.
And they got in trouble for that. And it's like, well, actually, we just built a set that looks so like the underground. And you watch it and you're like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't look anything like that.
Not at all. It's not like they're watching The Wheel in Space or whatever and NASA's ringing them up saying, you're not allowed to go on the moon. What are you doing? Did you go on a Sunday morning, you bastards, with that Paddy Russell secret filming on the moon? I don't know why people like you, Richie, are always calling out these actors for these stories, because they've got to entertain us at the end of the day with these tidbits.
Well, we paid good money to see them, so
that's right.
Print the legend. That's what they say. I mean, the thing that I always come back to, and I sound like a fucking broken record, but the thing that always has to be remembered is that Doctor Who was being watched on a TV like that size by a lot of people. Hmm. You know what I mean? Sort of the memories is just like this.
Which
tiny...
is why I can believe the Web of Fear story, because it is a tiny screen.
Yeah.
And you've got some guy who's been sent a letter by the BBC going, oh, here, can we film at your underground station? He's like, no, you can't. No. And then he's watching Doctor Who that night and he's like, hold on a fucking minute. Is that Marble Arch?
Yeah, bastard.
I can't get a bigger image of it. But
his eyes will be fucked because he was in the war, and he's probably like had 10 pints that day. By and
his living room is just fucking a yellow fog of cigarette smoke. He's been drinking since the football started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He's fucked.
And he's a paedophile.
He's exhausted from battering his kids.
He's eaten nothing but boiled potatoes and boiled meat his entire life.
But it's funny. It's hard. It's hard. It's one of the hardest things to judge, I think, without context. Like, I remember there's a shot in The Empty Child. Like, some of the stuff in the mill, maybe it's because it was an SD, but some of the shots in the mill that the mill were putting out in the early days, I was looking at going, holy, this is unbelievable stuff. And I watch it now and I'm like, oh, no, it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that the dinosaurs, in total of all the footage, there's not really much of that T-Rex looking as really bad. I think in totality, I don't think the dinosaur footage is particularly stands out versus anything else.
I think because it's the docs who keep saying, it's like the dinosaurs aren't the story here. This is, it's a distraction. And I think that what I love about Invasion of the Dinosaurs, I think what everybody loves about it is the actual story at the heart of it. It's like a big political eco-thriller that every now and again has to stop for a dinosaur puppet to kind of come on screen and menace somebody. Because it's Doctor Who at the end of the day. It's not Doomwatch. Mm-hmm. It has to, do that kind of thing.
Like, it doesn't sag. I feel like it doesn't sag at any point.
I think the Pertwee sort of 6 and 7 parters are really good for that.
Yeah.
Like Dex and Letts were very much like, it's a 4-parter and a 2-parter, or a 3-parter and a 4-parter, or like 2 3-parters.
Yeah.
Like there's always a kind of like, it wraps something up and then it kind of moves on to the next thing, but it's all still, it's basically like your long form Netflix shows nowadays.
And I'm sure everybody has guessed that this car belongs to none other than Doctor Who, alias John Pertwee, magnificently driven in. John, welcome to Blue Peter.
Hello, Peter. Let me clunk click.
Yes, every trip. And it certainly is the most extraordinary car I've ever seen, either in the studio or on the road, for that matter.
It is, isn't it?
John, it looks rather like a hovercraft. Is it allowed to go on the road?
Yes, it is. It's designed by a brilliant designer from Nottingham, Peter Farris. And PCF Motors, who makes it, or made it. It's a one-off. There's nothing like it in the world.
I'm sure.
And it isn't a hovercraft. It's a proper car.
So, yeah, I've written down Whomobile. So is this the first...
Well, Richie, it's interesting you mention the Whomobile. Because that actually it maybe is a bit early, I don't know, but it does lead us into the game that I have prepared for this episode.
Oh, okay. You know what? It's your episode, so...
Shall we do it? Shall we do it?
Let's go for it.
Okay, now, obviously, in previous episodes, Owen and Gav have come up with some astonishing games. RTD or R2-D2 or whatever it was. Yeah. Phenomenal. Phenomenal.
I hope this
kind of comes, just even if it's half the game that was.
Hey, look, this is more prep than I've done. So,
So as we all know, Invasion of the Dinosaurs is the first story to feature the beloved Whomobile. So I thought it'd be the perfect time to talk about Doctor Who's other famous cars in a game that I like to call the car is the star.
Ooh. Very good.
So I've got 6 questions here about Doctor Who and his love of motor vehicles. Now, they're
I'm legit excited about this. I'm on board here.
Now, they're all multiple choice, so I'm going to... There's six questions, and I'm going to just kind of move around you all.
Excuse me, we don't need multiple choice, mate.
Oh, no, you might. You might. So there's multiple choice here. So basically, if whoever I ask the question to, if they get it wrong, one of the other players has a chance to steal. Okay?
Okay.
That is the rules. Are we all happy?
Yeah.
So happy.
Okay, question number one. How fast was Colin Baker going when he was fined £480 for speeding and banned from driving for 21 days?
Okay,
was
we're going to need multiple choice
now,
on
I'm going to... This is for Richie, first of all, so we're going to go Richie, Dylan, Mikey, because that's how you have been. Okay. So Richie, was Colin Baker going 58 miles per hour in a 30 zone, 44 miles per hour in a 40 zone, or 90 miles per hour on the motorway?
Now, are these answers based on his account, or is it based on...
This is based on the actual court reporting.
I'm going to say 58 in a 30.
And you'd be right, my friend.
Yay.
Great work.
So, I can't remember what year this was, but basically his excuse was that he was trying to catch up with a BBC camera car after losing them while doing some filming, presumably... for the Blu-ray box sets, because this was like a couple of years ago.
I was going to say, he's not speeding recently, is he? Is he allowed on the road
double
still?
Double the speed limit as well. Double the speed limit. Someone could have been killed. You know?
I'm surprised his car can go that fast.
All right, Richie's got 1 point. So, Dylan, my question to you. David Burton is best known for being the alternative Eighth Doctor and for being gifted or did he con a brand new Proton car out of which motor dealership? Was it A, Car City UK, B, Gary P's Motor Co, or C, Shield Motor Group?
I want to say C.
Oh, I know this one.
You'd be right, because it's fucking emblazoned all the way along the side of the car, because that was part of the deal, was to promote. Because he's the new Doctor Who. He's going to promote their motor dealership. Honest, Gov. Mikey Smith.
I know you're baiting me. I'm not going to bite.
Mikey Smith, how are you?
I'm great.
Question number
three. I can see why you did give me the David Burton question.
Well, yeah, because you would have got right. But then did they go right? Because he's the Wilderness Years guy. I should have given it to Richie, but he... Anyway. Question number three. Mikey, in 2001... Peter Davison made a citizen's arrest when a youth broke into his car. But what did the little scroll attempt to steal from Davo's motor? Was it A, a brown envelope containing all the cash he'd made at a recent convention appearance? Was it B, his all cricket grand. Gear? Or was it C, a video camera containing pictures and footage of the birth of his child?
So what year was this?
2001.
Okay, so it could be a video camera. People used to use devices such as video cameras back then.
Cash in hand? Wages.
He does love a brown envelope for the cash.
He does. That's why he has a rucksack with him, so he can just put them in. I think... What was the third one? So cash...
Cash, of his... cricket gear, or a video camera containing...
Well, it's not cricket gear. That's you being humorous. So I'm going to take that out of the equation. Or you may be second-guessing me. You're a genius, basically.
I mean, I could have put a bag of celery in there as well. And
that's just true.
No one's chasing after celery.
He fucking loves it, Davo, doesn't he?
I don't think Davo's playing much cricket these days.
What about in 2001, though?
Oh, shit. Okay, I've made a lot of bad decisions in my life, so I'm not going to go with my instincts.
So was the kid that smashed in Davison's car. Oh my God.
Absolutely.
Is he out yet, that kid? Can we get him on the podcast?
Okay. Right, give us your answer.
Okay, I'm going to go with the... No, it's not the cricket gear. It can't be the cricket gear. It's not the cash, because he looks after his cash. He's not leaving it in a car. So it's either the video footage. It's the video footage.
You're absolutely right. Now, actually, the interesting thing about this is that this isn't why Davison put the kid under citizen's arrest, as he explained in a statement to the press, in which he said about this young man, he was flailing about with what I thought was a knife for quite a bit, but I looked down and couldn't see any blood. So I just wrestled him to the floor and basically sat on him for 10 minutes. He said he'd give the video camera back. It was then that I realised that the pictures from all day at the hospital were on it. So the reason he chased the kid was just because he smashed his window in.
Wait a minute. Maybe what he was waving around was one of them Sharpie pens, and in his other hand was a VHS copy of Kinder. And this is all one big mix-up.
God, Davison really does seem like a citizen's arrest type.
This is what happens though when you don't pay Davo the £20 before you get his autograph. Yeah. You just end up him sitting on you for 10 minutes until you hand it over.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's ridiculous because he does accept Stripe transactions.
He does. Yeah. Which I thought, you know, HMRC would be more, you know.
I don't think he reports all of his takings to HMRC somehow.
Do you know what? Just for fun, let's go back the way. So, Mikey, question number 4. So, you've all got 1 point each so far. Oh. Well done, congratulations. There is a tiebreaker, so don't worry.
Okay, good.
Question number 4. Which group of motoring enthusiasts did John Pertwee say would tell him what to do to Aunt Sally from Wurzel Gummidge? Was it A, the caravan and motor?
I know you know this one. Is it for me, this?
It's for you, yeah. Do you want to do it?
Okay, this isn't because I know it. I've heard enough of John Pertwee's bullshit anecdotes to know what he would go for.
Okay.
It's got to be the Hells Angels.
It is the Hells Angels. Well done, Mikey Smith.
Because that's how he tells stories. He goes for he's a bullshitter.
Exactly. Well done.
I know my bullshit celebrity anecdotes. My God.
So Mikey's on 2 points. Dylan Reese. Doctor, who the hell said this? In an entirely organic and not at all prepared statement about the Audi A1 Sportback. So I'm laughing at my own jokes. Right, as a music fan, I don't want to be limited to a playlist that I burnt onto a CD. So the fact you can stream music from your phone straight to your car is really cool. Who said this? Which Doctor Who said this? Was it A, Peter Capaldi? Was it B, Jodie Whittaker? Or was it C, Shuti Gatwa?
This is good. So I don't think it's Gatwa, because he strikes me as someone that doesn't drive.
He doesn't even know what a CD is, Gatwa.
Yeah, exactly.
Too young.
So it's between...
Actually, he's like 2 years younger than me. That's bollocks.
What car did they say it about?
The Audi A1 Sportback.
Is that a modern car?
You tell me.
I'm going to go Peter Capaldi.
You would be wrong. It was your favourite Doctor and mine, Jodie Whittaker, who was at one point an Audi brand ambassador, because this was from the official Audi magazine.
A woman in a car?
Good. Yeah.
Good idea, bad idea.
That's when I unsubscribed from Audi magazine. Because it had gone too woke.
Okay, Richie, the final question, and if you get this right, you and Mikey go through to the tiebreaker question. In 2013, Matt Smith sold his manky old Vauxhall Corsa for £6,300 to raise money for the Starlight Children's Foundation. What a guy.
Lovely.
But what affectionate nickname did he give the car? Was it A, the Shagger, B, the Shed, or C, Vauxhall of Time and Space, everything that ever happened or ever happened? I'm going to say that again because I fucking fluffed the last bit, like William Hartnell. Okay. Was it A, the Shagger, B, the Shed, or was it C, Vauxhall of Time and Space, everything that ever happened or ever will?
That's very good. Now, at 2013, there's a lot of eyes on them. There's no danger a doctor's coming and saying his car's called the Shagger.
Sure, but this was the car that he owned.
Was that the Cloisterbell? What the fuck was that?
It was the microphone stand.
Oh, okay.
Now, this was the car he had owned since he was a teenager, just as a kind of...
Oh, so this was 2013. You know, people were still shagging back then. I mean, we're not
away with it now. But... Yeah, we weren't all traumatized by, you know, free porn poured directly into our eyeballs 24/7.
No, I'm going to go with the shed.
It was indeed the shed. How exciting. Richie has 2 points. Mikey has 2 points. And do you
know
what?
A bit of extra spice to the game.
This question had better be about Sadie Miller.
So it's a tiebreaker question. And it borders on a proper...
Because I do know where she is at any particular point in time.
Okay, so this tiebreaker question borders on a legitimate pub quiz question. So I do apologise for that. And what I'll do is... Whoever says the name quickest... Give me the answer.
This is going to be really funny with the delay.
Yeah. Well, won't it just? Let's see how that works. Okay, so the tiebreaker question is, in Top Gear's star in a reasonably priced... Sorry, I'll say that properly. Star in a reasonably priced car segment, which new series Doctor achieved the best lap time?
From who?
Well, okay, fine. I was like, are they going to buzz in? Are they going to buzz in? No.
Do me and Richie strike you as Top Gear fans?
We just have to choose. We're just going to
Mikey, you hover between the poles, you know?
You're saying you're a centrist dad.
Anyway.
Okay, guilty.
Was it A, Chris Freckleston?
No, we don't need multiple choice.
No. I'm going to say Matt Smith.
Okay, I'm going to say, so Chris Rexton ain't going on fucking Top Gear because he hates everything.
Oh, yeah.
He's not going on there.
I feel like David Tennant is too safe.
David Tennant's going to go on and say, oh, let someone else win. And do his Proclaimers fucking whatever.
Again.
Did you see his stand-up? Yes. Like, oh, God. No one's perfect, eh, lads? Right. So not him. Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi we've got. Is this... What year was this?
I'm asking which of the Doctors was the fastest.
Okay, well, Jodie Whittaker's a Richie girl,
said
so
Matt
I'll
Smith.
Take her out of the equation.
Was it Joe Martin?
Well, I mean, look, do you want me to tell the answer? Because what
wait a minute, Joe okay. Martin, is she a legitimate driver? Okay, I'm going to go Peter Capaldi.
Richie was correct. It was Matt Smith. And as far as I'm aware, it's only Matt Smith, David Tennant and Chris Freckleston who ever appeared on Top Gear.
So Chris Freckleston did go on Top Gear?
He did. He was the first one. He was the first one to
do it.
Oh,
I'd love to see that.
I think it was to promote 2005.
So was he all happy and...
I think he was doing that thing of like, I am contractually obligated to promote this show that I am no longer a part of.
Like Shooty Gatler is now.
But it was Matt Smith. Do you want the times? Are you those race nerds? Do you want the times?
Well, we're here now. We may.
All right, let's get it over with. Matt Smith did it in 1 minute and 43.7 seconds. I've heard that about him. Yeah, he can go forever, ain't he? David Tennant did it in 1 minute 48.8 seconds. And Christopher Eccleston did it in 1 minute 52.4 seconds. A tender lover.
Mark, well done. Thank you very much.
Yes, great, Chris. Very well deployed.
The humour, Bill, eh?
So anyway, the humour... Yeah, the Whomobile in its very brief appearance. It was like he was back into a Jeep 2 episodes later.
Where does he park? Because he kind of parks out of the side of the station, gets involved in all sort, gets chased by a dinosaur, gets into a Jeep with a brig, and I guess just leaves it parked on a street for a couple of weeks.
I can't remember. Does it fly? It doesn't fly, does it?
It
not
doesn't
in this
fly
one.
At the spiders, no, but no. Not yet.
Yeah,
because the break has that line, doesn't it, where he's like, you're never getting that off the ground, Doctor.
Which is, again, really good because they build it. You know what I mean? It builds. When you get to Planet of the Spiders,
it's a hell of
something
a payoff.
Extra.
It gets a whole fucking episode to itself in Black Spiders.
Is there any chat as to why it's only has one appearance and then it's gone for the rest of the
Paddy Russell fucking hated it as far as the documentary goes.
Oh.
So she tells a story where I think this was after they'd done the 4 AM film, and I don't think Part 2 turned up. Like in the sort of central London at 4 AM driving his Scootmobile going, hello. But yeah, basically she was like, what the hell is that? He's like, oh, it's the Hoomobile. And she's like, oh, okay, well, we'll use that as much as it pleases you, and then we'll never show it for the rest of the episode.
But isn't that the whole thing with the Hoomobile? Pertwee had it built, not the BBC. So it was his, and he was just... And I can just imagine Barry Letts going, what the fuck is this?
Because well, Pertwee tells that story, which again, I'm sure Mikey will punch holes through, that he went
I'm
to
on
some...
Standby.
He went to some guy. He went to some guy that designed, you know, phenomenal classic cars, and asked him to create Doctor Who's perfect car. And he did a sketch, and he showed me the sketch, and he said, "Would that do?" And I said, "Would that do? That is the car." And then he gave them the car, and he drove it up to fucking BBC Television Centre and honked the horn. Oh no, it was the Aston Hilton. That was it.
Foldable
the
caravan
horn, Barry Letts is Barry Letts is four floors up looking out the window going, what the bloody hell is that? And John Pertwee's like, it's the Hoomobile. And Barry Letts is like, oh my God, what a wonderful fucking invention. Let's include it in Doctor Who. And
I've got no problem with that story.
One of my favourite Pertwee stories is though where he talks about getting rid of the car and he says, well... You know, I met a guy who'd lost his son. A guy who's lost his wife. He said he lost his wife under terrible circumstances. And you think, oh, he's going to say, so I just gave the kid the car. He goes, and so I sold it to him for several thousand pounds.
Oh, wow. So, because I looked into this.
What a bastard.
I looked into this on the British newspaper archive. And there was like a thing, there was like a newspaper article about how much the Hoomobile had sold for. And it made it sound as if it was an auction and it had sold to like a flamboyant figure or something like that. So,
I think that's after. Yeah. So it's changed hands quite a few times since.
And well, then he sort of drives it around the South Bank more than 30 years in the TARDIS, doesn't he?
If Pertwee tells a story that doesn't end in a punchline, I believe him. It's a general rule. And so what Dylan has said, I think, is exactly the truth, because he says it with such sincerity. You know, he's died in terrible circumstances, so I did him a good price, you know. Joke's on Pertwee, though, because he left the cash in a brown envelope and then some Asbo kid broke into his car and he had to perform a citizen's...
And that kid grew up to be John Levine. Somehow.
That's right.
So actually let's talk about Unit for a bit and where Unit is at this point, I guess. What's quite funny about this episode of the podcast is that I realise that I've had a solid run of Unit stories. An unbroken
run. Well, 'cause you've been watching the kind of season 7 Blu-ray box set as well.
Of course. Yeah, because we did Robot and so I need to, whatever we do next is not it's time to move on.
Maybe you need to watch Kinder.
Maybe.
It's fucking great.
It is good. But as Gavin Owen would say, Benton heads were eating well this week.
It's genuinely, I would say, I mean, and you know, I know we joke about, well, I'm sorry, this is too much in jokey, but John Levine is an interesting figure.
That's putting it lightly, yeah.
He's a fucking madman.
But I think he does his best work in this story. Agreed. Everybody points the time monster because he gets to turn into a baby and ha 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 ha. But this is great. Like I love Benton in this. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that he's not the guy getting the tease, he's got other people to do that for him, you know, for a start. And then also the fact that he's the one person that you, the audience, and the Doctor trusts. Because even though we all know that Mike Yates is a traitor, there's still like a kind of like little bit of suspicion towards the Brigadier. Like, is he in it as well?
Yeah.
Because he's kind of going along with it. And so it's Benton who's like, right, come on. What's going on here? Yeah. And it's like, well, Mike Yates is a traitor. Not sure about the Brig, but I need to get off and, you know, solve the problem. And he's like, all right, do your Venusian, was it the Venusian Ua or whatever it is?
Uja,
that's it. Yeah. And yeah, it's just lovely. It's such a lovely moment. And like, I know, like, Levine, for listeners that aren't sort of hardened Doctor Who fans that have been listening to these bloody convention panels for the past 20 years, John Levine is never not telling you about how close he was with John Pertwee. And I don't know how much I believe that, but I think if you watch their interactions in this, you kind of go, yeah, maybe actually there was something there. Maybe they were quite...
Yeah. John Pertwee was a better actor than he let on and other things. My favourite moment in the whole thing is where Benton asks for a camp bed. But he says it in a way that it's made out like he's asking for a bed that is camp rather than a camp bed.
So like the mattress and the floor of Richard Franklin's...
It is good, though, for the pair of them. It's like Malcolm Hulk didn't get the memo of what everyone else knows, which is, look, these two guys are shit. Whatever you do, don't give them too many lines. Malcolm will just come in as if they're actual actors and they've got characters and just given them. And suddenly we're like, actually, this could work. This is great. This is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, overall as well, as a unit story, it's just great because it's throwing a lot of uncertainty into like the chain of command and the ideas of authority. And obviously the Doctor's always been a kind of anti-authority figure, but like having everyone else question what's going on and... Or even just the moment at the start where the army comes in and like, I think we should just start shooting people.
Yes. And like, that guy at the start with the fucking, he fires the machine gun off in the air for about 20 minutes. Oh,
yeah. I also, speaking of shooting, that there's a shot where the two soldiers jump down to shoot the Tyrannosaurus Rex and one of the soldiers is pointing in completely the opposite direction. But no, I just think it's like, I think it's a, you know, given that at this point, I imagine UNIT are starting to feel maybe a little bit fatigued. And I guess we're in a series where like we're having an episode where they're away and then they come back and they're back at UNIT. And, but yeah, no, it was a really great story to like to throw some challenges at the Brigadier even.
I love the Doctor and the Brigadier in this because I think we all think that the Doctor and the Brig spent so much time together being best pals, like, oh, but that's not really actually true.
No,
but in this, it's absolutely there. The bit in part six where, like, he's trying to blow up the tube station to get into the underground tunnels, and he sends the Brig off with some flares to distract the Triceratops, and he's like smiling, and the Brig's absolutely delighted with himself, like, distracting. It's just lovely. It's just
the
like
Dad's
these
Army
are two
unit
mates.
Is
yeah, it's Dad's
is
Army.
My favorite
it's absolutely
unit.
That. Yeah.
People keep banging on about how oh, it all become a bit comical after a while, and I'm like, no, this is my unit. You know,
yeah.
The unit in the Ambassadors of Death is it's just boring. Ambassadors of Death is shit. It's just
what?
Boring.
It's not, but okay.
This is my unit, you know. This is the kind of unit that could go on and do an Edinburgh Festival show. that's the kind of unit I'm interested in.
No, I mean, well, I think, yeah, given, you know, you throw that challenge in and everything that's happening in the episode and it really starts to establish what all these characters mean to each other as well.
Yeah.
Because you're right. You're like, you're watching up and... Until that moment, you're watching characters who there's obviously a mutual respect there, but the Doctor and the Brigadier have this back and forth where he's always kind of, you know, pushing against him or just taking the piss even. And then, you know, you have this moment, now they're all in trouble and it's like they've got each other's backs and it's really nice. It's just very nice,
Richie.
In a way that's, you know, how old 70s tell you can't quite do sincerity.
Yeah.
Richie.
Yeah.
Which of the Doctors is your dad?
That's an emergency question.
Don't worry, Mark.
Which of the Doctor Who's is your dad?
Because I've got an answer to it, and I know you have as well, Richie. And you're laughing it off, but you have. Which one of the Doctors?
I've got an answer, but I don't think it's my dad.
Is your dad?
I mean, you know what? Like, it is. as soon as you asked me that question, I was like, I have to think about that. But the answer, my gut just went Pertwee.
Yeah. Yeah. He's my dad too.
He's kind of, he's still quite authoritative. He's still a bit grumpy, but then he has the light edge to him as well.
Yeah. Tom's always... my uncle.
Yeah.
Patrick Trenton's all of our dads though. Biologically speaking.
Biologically, yeah.
Yeah, but he'd never come round, would he? Because he's got so many families.
He wouldn't. Of course he wouldn't. But
he's going round with brown envelopes full of cash. In fact, maybe it was him.
Fraser Hines fucking keeping the engine warm on the outside.
Dylan, which one's your dad?
I think... maybe he's Colin Baker because he's very, very angry and sometimes a bit violent. Or maybe he's Tom Baker in Soho in the 70s because he's also drunk quite a lot.
But I actually don't mean which one's like your dad.
Right.
I mean, which one is your replacement dad?
I can pick a replacement.
Because to me, it's a replacement dad.
Okay, all right, then Joe Martin.
Okay, on to Mark. Mark.
I think... to further your thesis, it is Pertwee. There is something quite paternal about him. But actually, in terms of just generally speaking, Sylvester McCoy in recent years, and I've met him at conventions, I've chatted to him for longer than I should have been allowed to chat to him. You know, you kind of sidle up to these people at bars and stuff. And you see that mischievous Scottish man of a certain age, and he just reminds me of my granddad who died like 16 years ago. But like, he's so full of that kind of like, Richie, I don't know if you know what I mean, but this kind of weird sort of like old Scottish man mischievousness.
Yeah, no, know? I know what you mean.
So that's my heartfelt answer, but
and
I think Pertwee is definitely...
It's a heartfelt question. I do think... that for us lads, this is why girls don't understand Doctor Who. For us lads, I think in amongst those dusty VHS videos, we're looking for guidance.
Who's yours, Mikey?
It's Pertwee, yeah, it's Pertwee, Pertwee. But Tom is the naughty uncle.
He's the uncle you want rather than the uncle. You want.
He's the one that'll give you a beer.
And you might never, you know, we all, I mean, don't we? You know, we all, you know, and we.
Imagining Baker is like, he's giving you a can and he's putting on a Black Sabbath record and you're like, oh, come on, man.
Yeah, and he's saying, have you ever tried meth? And you're like, well, yeah. But no, I'm just saying that in amongst our DVDs and our Blu-rays, maybe we're looking for something more than a shiny disc.
Oh, my God. I don't think I can go on. This is so emotional. I'm getting a stalk on, I think, here.
We've covered a fair bit of ground here, but I want to talk about... I'd like to talk about Sarah Jane. I don't know why I did that voice, but as Mark mentioned earlier, she has quite a lot to do in this story. And it's quite funny because the last Doctor Who story I watched before this was The Demons. And watching Jo do her thing in that was a bit like... You know, I felt a bit kind of bad for her. Because not only every time she did something, someone called her an idiot or told her to shut up. But anyway, so Sarah Jane's different. We've got, she's a bit more, she's quite proactive. And she's a journalist. And she's actually trying to do some journalism. But I think, I won't go into too much, but the big moment halfway through the story is her waking up in a spaceship. Which again, going in blind is just like, holy shit.
One of the best Doctor Who cliffhangers. It's great.
Yeah. All that up at this stage. Yeah. It's just brilliant.
I know.
And
it's brilliant. You've got to look through a lot of Doctor Who to find moments like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Carmen Silvera's there.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we talked about Dad's Army Doctor Who. Hello, Doctor Who.
Hang on, that was the Last of the Summer Wine.
No, it fucking wasn't. Last Summer Wine is...
That's what you did the first time.
No, you're right. I thought you did Last of Summer Wine as well. Wait, what was... That was Aloha Lo.
Aloha Lo is... Sorry. No, I'm not going to do that again.
But how good that moment. It's just... It's a great kind of... little magic reveal. It just doesn't happen very often. I mean... So what about so Face of Evil, when you see Tom Baker's face on the side of the, that's like that, you know? It's those moments where you go, fuck, you know, brilliant.
I don't know if this is mentioned in the documentary, Mark, but was there any sort of cult stuff happening in the news around that point?
Not so much in terms of the space stuff. I think because one of the things in the documentary is, it's like the first half of it is very much like, oh, you think it's the shit dinosaur one though? But what? Why do all these fucking idiots believe they're on a spaceship? The stupid cunts. Mm. It kind of has that kind of tone for the first half hour. But there is a thing about how Malcolm Hulk is kind of talking about this idea of the, which is still quite relevant today, the kind of militant left who are kind of forcing this kind of like Brave New World, this kind of like way of like this sort of utopian idea.
Yeah, Biden's absolutely fine. He's completely in control of all his senses. What are you all talking about? This is all fine. It's the same, right? For the listener, Mark just nodded his head.
With reservations. So I think it's more, I think, the idea of I think Matthew Sweet brings up, there was a sort of conversations between sort of the government and the military about kind of not so much martial law, but like, would things be better if there was a more kind of authoritarian rule? And this idea of this sort of British state operating in kind of direct opposition to the British people. And so sort of Hulk's context, kind of pulling on all of these things to kind of tell this mad story with dinosaurs and sort of like imaginary spaceships and time travel and all that kind of thing.
Can I give some context that our illustrious Lord and Master Matthew Sweet doesn't bring in the documentary?
Oh, yeah.
Which is that this was around the time of the power restrictions.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a talking point around what you can tell the public to do.
Oh, so like the forced power cuts?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. That's true.
Where you literally were told, I mean, it's very comparable to COVID in a sense, where the government was speaking directly to you at number 43 Melvin Avenue and saying, do this tonight. And that's very rare in history. And they were saying, you know, light a candle tonight.
Yeah.
Do not put your... And if you do put your electric on, your neighbours will shame you. If you, you know, which is very similar to, if you do go out and socialise with your friends, your neighbours will shame you. So that was the context to this. So that probably helps create some of the, I don't know, anxiety that was being explored. But as I say, I'm not saying I'm better than Matthew Sweet. I wouldn't say it. I'm just saying I'm adding an extra layer to what he, you know, his decent attempt at a DVD.
No, but it is a good point, that idea of kind of government overreach, I suppose. And that is what ultimately the story is kind of about.
I mean, it had me thinking about what was going on a lot at the time. I mean, again, I'll look into it after we record, but you know, it's stuff like it felt very cultish. But there's lots of use of like protest footage and quite brutally violent, like, just because it's on a screen on the TV, it was sort of weirdly brutally violent footage going on.
So one of the things that they do bring up in the documentary is not so much the protest, which of course there was, you know, it was the early stage of the miners' strike. It was, you know, look at America throughout the 70s. That's a very tumultuous time. But also there was a lot of books talking about the kind of oncoming climate crisis. So there was the, what was it called? Manual for Survival, I think it's called.
A Blueprint for Survival.
A Blueprint for Survival, that's it, yeah.
Is that the one Green Death kind of basically?
Which influenced the Green Death.
Right, yeah,
and
okay,
then
the
Population Bomb was the book that kind of influenced this, which was this idea that everybody was really worried about oh, everyone's having sex and sort of procreating and mm-hmm. and this kind of baby boom and all that kind of thing. And it's like, that's going to be a drain on resources. Like, let's imagine a future in which there's enforced contraception and social control. And so that element of it kind of plays into this idea of this kind of idealized colony of people on this spaceship, in inverted commas, that are going to land on this brave new world that is basically just Earth, just, you know, dialed back.
The spaceship is a traveling Emperor's New Clothes. That's what it is. It's everyone is fooled into the most ridiculous thing just by circumstances.
I love that bit though. Like,
I love it. Oh my god, I absolutely. It's the best thing ever.
It gets really silly towards the end though, where like Sarah Jane's like constantly coming back and forth out of that airlock. You know, like the first time she does it, you're like, oh my god, this is great. Where she's like, look, I'm going to open this airlock, and if I'm not sucked off into space and killed, all right, well, come on,
back
grow
to
up,
your sex life.
Grow up.
But then we have, you have that moment as well where they're like, she's a disruptive influence. We're probably going to have to.
Oh, yeah, because what she's doing is she's pointing out the obvious, which makes her a disruptive influence. Now, how resonant is this? And interestingly, you know, I mentioned before about Terence Dix on the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Terence Dix, who I think we can assume is further to the right.
Fairly right wing.
100%.
Yeah. But kind of a cuddly right wing, you know, like your granddad.
Yeah, so,
you know.
But what Uncle Terence says is that the only difference between the far right and the far left is that the far right say, we're going to punish you by putting you in a prison, starving you and beating you. The far left say, we're going to put you in a prison, starve you and beat you because it's for your own good. And that he literally says it on the commentary.
He does,
there's two interesting things about that, which is that it means that Terence, the script editor, was totally zoned in on what this script was about. Mm. But secondly, which is interesting, if that commentary had been recorded now for a Blu-ray release, that comment wouldn't have been in it.
No, we
have to ask ourselves, is that fact that I've just stated a good example of the problem with the portrayal of the left and right debate that this show itself is trying to address? Basically, there's something really clever going on here, and I'm at the heart of it.
I think the reason why this era works is because you have Barry Letts, who's very much on the left, and Terence Dix, who's very much on the right, and they sort of cancel each other out and go, maybe don't do that. But also, they're also very willing to have conversations about their politics and disagree on things rather than
without falling out.
Yeah,
and Malcolm Hulk. I mean, Malcolm Hulk was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party, but at the same time, he was very much taking a macro view and not that kind of tribalism that we have now. He was kind of going, yeah, the Communist Party's got some great fucking ideas, but also maybe they could tone this down and, you know, and all
but
that.
But also, the only evidence we have that Malcolm Hulk was a communist is from what Terence Dix has said, which if it's Terence Dix saying...
Oh, no, there's
MI5.
There is MI5 documents.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
There's MI5 documents. It was in the documentary that's just come out about him.
Oh, right.
Oh, is this on a Blu-ray release?
It is indeed.
I can't afford Blu-rays because I'm left.
Not even. I've not even opened mine yet. That's annoying.
Well, that's your problem, Richie. That's why you haven't seen this fucking story, because you've got the cellophane on everything. You've got a copy of Robots of Death there, released in 1993 with its cellophane on and its R Price sticker.
I don't. I promise I've watched Robots of Death, at the very least.
You're the first to recover.
You're bound to feel a little strange at first.
Who are you?
We're the Elders.
How did I get here?
You must have been chosen.
Wait a minute. I know you. You're Lady Cullingford.
Here I am, Ruth.
I interviewed you about that private members' bill of yours against the pollution of rivers. And you're Nigel Castle, the novelist.
Not anymore. I have better work for my hands.
I know you too. You're...
John Crichton.
The athlete. You jumped 2.362 metres in the last Olympics.
All that's behind us now.
And you were a journalist?
I still am. Where are we going?
I told you to New Earth.
Sorry, I seem to have forgotten.
Christ, that got deep. I don't think people expect that from... No, I know what you mean.
But it is that kind of story. Because the other thing that really struck me watching it, this is the first time I've seen this since Orphan 55 went out.
Uh-huh.
And Orphan 55 gets a lot of flack from a certain type of Doctor Who fan for going, well, Jodie Whittaker just stops the story to tell us all to start using paper straws and stop being cunts. John Pertwee does that in
literally does that right at the end.
He doesn't look directly at the camera, but he might as well have done.
Yeah.
The whole speech where the Brigadier's like, oh, it's never going to happen. Come on, Doctor, don't be ridiculous. And I was like, no, you really need to start taking this seriously. Like, and that was almost 50 years ago.
It's exactly the same thing he does. Is it Orphan Food? I thought it was the... What's the episode with the plastics on the beach?
That's Praxeus. They do it in both.
Oh, do they do it in both?
Orphan 55 is the big one, though, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah. Right, okay.
She's like, don't be the dregs.
She's wrong about plastic straws, though.
Yeah,
paper,
I think...
Paper straws
the
just
one
go
thing,
wet.
The one thing I want to keep are plastic straws. Everything else, I don't care, but...
I agree. You
know, I like the metal ones.
I don't want to suck a Tango Ice Blast through some... soggy cardboard.
Where'd you get metal? Where'd you get? No, you live in London, Dylan.
Yeah,
so
well, exactly. Everything metal. I drink's out of an old jam jar through a metal straw. it's actually an old man's catheter. That's the worst thing. It's just been repurposed.
Nicholas Courtney's catheter.
To be fair, that is the solution. Just walk around with a metal straw in your pants.
Yeah, I do.
So I've heard.
Christ, I don't even know where it goes.
struggling to maintain control of this podcast.
You guys will have heard me say this before, but your listeners may not because it's a new audience. A few months ago, I heard some footage from the first ever, well, a recorded audio of a panel at the first ever Doctor Who convention, and somebody in the audience asks Terence Dix if his era of the show was too preachy. And you replace that with woke, people are asking the same thing there. Like, there's
nothing new. There's nothing new.
No. There isn't. It is that thing when you watch old science fiction and they're doing a story, like you say, about the climate crisis or whatever's going on in politics or whatever, and it's all... There's that party that goes, oh, I can't believe, like, the foresight... this show had, and it's like, it's not foresight, it's just we've been doing this shit forever.
Yeah.
Look at Doomwatch. Doomwatch is just like, you know, party political broadcast. Very I do like Doomwatch, though. What do you guys think of Moonbase 3? Richie, obviously you won't have watched it.
I've never seen
Moonbase
3.
Doctor Who.
I've never seen Moonbase 3.
That's actually, yeah, I'd love to watch Moonbase 3, but I'm not.
You wouldn't.
Should we do a Moonbase 3 podcast?
It's so dull. We did it for Strangers in Space. I think it's one of the worst things that the BBC have made in the name of science fiction.
Have you not seen Biker Grove?
I'd rather watch Biker Grove.
Here, does Biker Grove not end with some
weird... Yeah, it ends where they all realise they're on a TV show,
yeah. It ends in this kind of like Brechtian... I really like the way it ends, Biker Grove, actually.
I mean, that really is a writing team going, fuck it, isn't it?
It's produced by, is it Andrew Morgan, former Doctor Who director?
Oh, I don't know, but I could imagine, yeah. Yeah. Because Russell T Davies was the other one. Why don't you, wasn't he? Why don't you?
Yeah. So I'll come to the closing kind of stuff in the episode, but there's some stuff I've written down here, like best of the British Army in pursuit of the Doctor. Every time he turns a corner, he loses them.
Yeah. You know, one of the bits I love in that is where they're all like looking for him, and he's just standing looking fucking really fucking menacing.
He's
about to just fucking brain somebody with a tree trunk.
And it is funny that you know, it's, until you say that at the start of the podcast, he really doesn't do very much, does he? He has his gun.
He's like,
doesn't, yeah.
He's got his little clipboard that says, do not forget.
Yeah.
On the clip for some reason.
was probably just his.
Yeah, I think
don't forget to turn up for work.
And he drives around with that and looks at some dinosaurs, runs around the countryside for a bit, drives variety of cars. Meanwhile, Sarah Jane's like, look, this is, you're not on a spaceship, you silly cunts.
Is it fair to say that Sarah Jane is a completely different character to when she's with Tom?
Yeah, something I was going to bring up, actually. That's, she feels quite different. Apart, like, again, she's doing journalism.
Yeah, I think it's that what happened was that they were like, right, we need to kind of have a more progressive female character. And then, so Malcolm Hulk taps into that. They do that in the Time Warrior, they do that in this. And then I think in the 2020s, a lot of discussion now about the Hinchcliffe and Holmes era. Mm. Like, we all love it. It's great. It's really atmospheric. But actually, is it all that progressive in terms of how it represents women? Like, there's
does
not
it need
a lot
to
of female
be?
Characters. Well, there's not only female characters in it. And Sarah Jane
does
becomes
it need to be?
Less... Yeah, but
does
she becomes...
Need to be? This is all a show I'm from saying, the 70s, Mark. Does it need to be?
All
yeah,
I'm
but
saying,
50%
Mike,
of the population
that...
was women in the 70s.
If we take the character of Sarah Jane Smith, Mikey, in this, and the character of Sarah Jane Smith in, I don't know, The Mask of Mandragora, they're poles apart, you know?
Aye, yeah. You think of her, like, saving the day in this and crying an event and...
Yeah,
there's been an active decision by the script editor and producer to dumb the character down. But by the time you enter the Tom Baker era, I think.
Well, you say dumb it down.
You did, yeah.
Well, maybe they just thought she should just sex it up a bit.
I wouldn't describe her sexed up in that era either. It's not like she's suddenly in a bikini.
Haven't you seen her in that yellow anorak?
I feel the need to explain to the audience because they can't see Mikey's,
Mikey's
mischievous half smile that's going on while he's saying all this.
Okay, just to your audience, I'm a character, I'm not a real person. So I'm a bit like Lorraine Kelly for tax purposes. Mikey Smith is a character. I don't mean anything I say. And my views change on a daily basis. So don't listen to a word of it. Isn't that right, lads?
Yeah, that is very
That's
true.
That's correct, yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, so I've got a couple of extra notes. I really like the shot of the Jeep driving under the dinosaur. I was just really impressed with
it's
how
ace.
Well laid out that
it's
was.
Good. It's good. It's good.
And also Benton fighting Yates.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. It doesn't last long. But also right at the end when they're like, what are you doing with Yates? Extended sick leave. Like, if that was a modern story and it was like... we had a character turning. They'd have to be either some sort of redemption arc in which he sacrifices himself and everyone's crying. And this is just like, I've given him sick leave.
Yeah. No, but
that's how we got this problem in the 70s.
Because what you would have had in modern Doctor Who or like a modern Netflix show was that you would have this like voiceover and go, oh, what are you going to do with Mike Yates? And he'd be in prison.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be a voiceover over him just staring at the fucking walls.
Yeah.
He's going to come back. Oh, what's going to happen? Is he going to be on the good side or the bad side?
But, not even court-martialed. Just take some time off.
That's the 70s, though. They brush things under the carpet like that. If he was a nonce, he'd still be out on sick leave.
Whoever writes this is in the wrong business because, I mean, all over America, for example, where there's terrible insomnia... I mean, if I put these on good quality tape, and people who haven't had a kip since 1946 will be in a fucking coma.
Let's bring things to a close on Invasion of the Dinosaurs. I'll just say, first of all, from my point of view, as Mikey pointed out, it was quite special for me to see some Pertwee I hadn't seen before, and it was extra special for me to be like, I love this. This is brilliant. I know when you're watching old Doctor Who, I guess, I don't know how you guys are, but there's obviously just a party that just accepts what's happening and just forgives a lot. And it's hard to even, I mean, this is the fun thing about doing this podcast with people who have no idea what's going on, because I realize how much I forgive and just go, that's just what it is. That's what it is. And they're still telling a great story and there's lots of great people involved. And, you know, it just is what it is. Yeah, brilliant. So I loved it.
So glad you enjoyed it. When I heard that you hadn't watched it and you were going to watch it, I just felt so excited for you. I wish they could invent a drug you could take and then watch something again anew.
It's called drugs, and you just have to take enough of it.
Can I just say something that would be remiss of me not to mention? So Invasion of the Dinosaurs, the warehouse where they... I think it's where... Let me just double-check this. Where the Doctor and Sarah find the looters.
Oh, yeah.
That is the West London Islamic... Well, it used to be. It's no longer there. The West London Islamic Centre, which is in Ealing. And I used to walk past that building to go and visit my good friend Ben Verth, my podcast co-host, when he lived in Ealing. So, yeah, this story does have a kind of special place in my heart for that.
Did you know?
So I knew through him, and Ben, he bought that flat, was like, I'm across the road from the fucking West London Islamic Centre from Invasion of the Dinosaurs, one of my favourite Doctor Who stories.
And he loves Islam.
And he does. He's massive. That's why he's got that big beard.
And he's always pointing east.
Yeah. I love the story. Because I think I was like you before this came out on video. When did this come out on video, Dylan?
It was one of the later ones. It was like post-TV movie. It's Photoshop covers. Yeah. Because everybody thought it was crap. Because
was it this and Ambassador's Death came out quite late on video?
Yeah.
I remember buying both of those. I remember watching Invaders and Dinosaurs for the first time and having, because I'd been in the Edinburgh Doctor Who group, that kind of thing of like, oh, there's shit dinosaurs. And because you're prepared for the shit dinosaurs, you go... This is actually an absolute corker of a story. You just forget the dinosaur element of it because it's the characters. The payoff. It goes, we've spent so many years with these characters. Let's do something really interesting with them and sort of put them push them in new directions. It's great.
You're right. I think it is the characters. And I think it's telling that all we've really talked about is the main, like our regulars. And there's so many other great cast members in there, Martin Jarvis, Peter Miles, John Bennett, people like that, who in any other Doctor Who story would be the standout element. But this like ensemble has come so far that actually we're just interested in the story they're telling with them because they're all getting their moments to shine. They're always all doing things a little differently. So it's a real like joy to watch in that respect.
It feels remiss for you to mention Peter Miles without us talking about what a dickhead he is on the audio commentary, which indeed is something he takes to every audio commentary, where his characters become fundamental to the show. And he gets closer to the mic than anyone can.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, God.
He describes Martin Jarvis as his sidekick in this show and then follows it up in the commentary by saying, me and Nicholas Courtney, our careers very much followed each other's careers, except he did some work in Norway, but I turned it down.
I've seen him interviewed several times. I've interviewed him myself as well. And he always refers to every actor he works with as my friend or my very good friend. And you know that those people were never returning the phone calls. I also saw him interviewed at a convention live on stage in front of 400 people, although he tells it as 1,000 people, where he was very anti-Semitic. He just kept going. Every time somebody mentioned an actor, he went, Jewish? Jewish? Ooh. See, they run everything. Jewish? And it was like,
wow.
Yeah, I know you think there's 1,000 people here, but it's not fucking rally, mate.
It's quite surprising from a man with such an obvious wig to be anti-Semitic.
Did you know the worst thing about his wig is? He goes completely bald in the 80s, like completely bald, and he attends conventions, and then one day he's just like full head of hair. It's like there's got to be that Chibnall crossover period where I know it's different now and you can have implants, but it's like where it's getting a bit thin and then, oh no, you've pulled it back. It's like you can't go bald then hair. I'm completely bald. If I suddenly had a big fucking afro, everybody would be like, Dylan, mate, what
Santa number 3's had a hair transplant.
Yeah.
Oh, it's for a role, mate.
Yeah.
You are in an extremely dangerous position, Doctor. I advise you to keep silent.
Well, that's just what you want, isn't it? My silence.
We really should interrogate this man now, sir. Try to discover his base, the names of his associates.
All that can come later.
Yes, well, now that you've caught me, General, you can end the evacuation and return your 8 million Londoners, can't you?
That decision doesn't rest with me. It rests with the Prime Minister. Captain Yates?
Sir?
Until further orders, you will keep that man under close arrest. Come with me, Brigadier.
Sir?
I want you with me when I make my report.
Conversely, the first sort of 15 Doctor Who commentaries are boring as shit because they've got no moderator.
Yeah.
And it's just a bunch of pensioners going, we shouldn't spoil it for people.
They think people haven't watched it. It's so funny. They think Barry Letts is going, oh, well, we need to be careful because people, what's wrong with them?
Is that
no
guy,
one brief them?
Is that guy Siner? He used to walk on the Compton Road dresses and that, see?
Oh, Christ.
I think, have you ever heard Jacqueline Pierce on the Blake 7 commentaries?
No, oh, but no. I bet they're fucking glorious.
Get involved. Literally, she spends the whole commentary just going, darling!
It was like I think this is a great wee kind of insight into why we all love Doctor Who, and I spent like, but more specifically old Doctor Who, because the kind of the world that surrounds it is just so mental,
yeah,
and interesting, and just full of these weird characters. The characters off the show are most often the stuff we talk about more than anything else.
People that walk down the street and nobody would bat an eyelid at them. But in this world of Doctor Who fans, there are 20,000 people who know who they are and know how fucking insane they are.
Yeah. And there's so much the stuff we talk about, there's so much like lore that's got nothing to do with the show at all.
Yeah.
It's about their behaviour in the bar.
But to bring it back around to this podcast, that's what I worry that we've done tonight. So I hope that people have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Enjoyed the podcast, you know.
I wish I could inject Doctor Who into my veins. Oh. I wish I could finger myself with Doctor Who.
I mean, you can finger yourself in something like it, I'm sure, but...
Yeah.
Have you ever tried that, Mark?
What? Finger myself with Doctor Who? No. No, they've never brought out Doctor Who finger puppets, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would have...
Don't forget the Davros dildo that they bought out.
What?
Excuse me?
You made that up?
No, I did. It was the Tardass spanking paddle that was real.
Oh wow!
And the dildeck, which
the
dildeck, was the
got, that was it.
You could see it. Yeah, I could see that. You can see it in my
head. Very bumpy.
See it in my
mind's
eye.
You can see it in the mind's eye for 2 weeks.
Hang on, how do you know that? That is Mary Whitehouse from 30 years in the TARDIS. Yeah.
No, I know.
I was just saying that. I didn't realize that was.
No, was that an accidental?
That is one of the most quoted Doctor Who things.
Oh, is it? Oh,
yeah.
Richie, was that an accidental Whitehouse?
It was, yeah, an accidental Whitehouse.
Oh my God, that is Dylan. That isn't it. That's one of the most quoted things from 30 years in the TARDIS.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
That's a great job. We should all convene here again to talk about more than 30 years in the TARDIS. It's great. It's such a good documentary.
Good.
Rich is not convinced.
No, I am. I am not. You
Rich
know what?
Like,
it, no, people. No, people talk about it so much that you know. I think it's one of those things you feel like you don't need to watch.
No,
oh, that's
you
like
do.
Game of Thrones. That's why I don't watch.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. You don't need to watch because I haven't watched it.
I've seen it.
That's
why Wilcox doesn't even show up.
If I haven't watched it, you don't need to watch it.
Right. Okay.
Is Caroline Ford reasonable. In Game of Thrones?
Don't think so.
She's the throne.
Okay, let's bring this to a close. First of all, I want to thank all three of you for coming on. It's been a lovely time, it's been a lovely time guiding me through a Doctor Who story as well, which has been fun. But I want to let you plug your stuff. So, Dylan, do you want to go first?
Yes, I will. I do a podcast called Doctor Who Too Hot for TV, and if the sort of nicheness of the things we've talked about tonight hasn't scared you off and you want a bit more. Doctor Who Too Hot for TV talks about everything but the TV show. We cover annuals, board games. I've just done an episode on Doctor Who Top Trumps that's coming up.
Oh, wow.
You know, books, short stories, audio adventures, all those things. I don't know whether it's accessible to non-fans, but we always do a little synopsis beforehand of the plot of the thing. So
yeah,
you don't
unlike us, Dylan will... unlike me, Dylan will explain what he's talking about.
Although, it has to be said, I get so bored of doing those. Recently, they've just been like, the TARDIS lands, they fight a monster, then they all leave. Because that's
yeah,
the worst part
the
of
most
it.
Recent episode with the unit... River Soundbox. I was like, he's phoning this in.
I just hate writing and recording those fucking little plot things. Anyway,
I really like them bits.
Oh well,
yeah, I like
I'm glad.
Well
I'm glad
to be bothered.
I would say the other thing I say about Too Hot for TV is it provides a very good service in the sense of sometimes it's Dylan has consumed this media, so you don't have
yes.
to.
That's fair. A lot of people say that.
Mark.
Hello. Yes. It's weird. So Ben and I have been doing On the Time Lapse for the past 11 years. And basically it's a podcast in which we work through the whole of new Doctor Who and we pair a story with classic Doctor Who. So all of that you can listen to. Currently we do a few YouTube live streams every month. So you can catch that on YouTube. And I might do another series of In the Time Lapse, which is basically... Room 101 for Doctor Who fans, in which they can come on and talk about their Doctor Who gripes and punt them into Paul Darrow's spangly opening. So yes, those are the things that I do, Doctor Who related.
Mikey, have you got anything to punt?
Not really. Like what?
You did the Burton interview for one, for fuck's sake.
Well, it's not. If you go and listen to that, I'm not making any money out of it.
Whereas we're fucking loaded from our podcast.
So yeah. So if you want to check out my, I would love to take up the podcast. So I'm a podcast consumer through listening to your three podcasts.
Oh, come
and
on.
Then I did guest spots on those, and I thought I'll do my own. So I did a few podcasts called Mikey and Who around the new show.
I broke Mikey's podcast.
Yes, I have an unreleased episode with Mark that I will bring out.
I don't think you will, because what happened was it was a Monday afternoon, and we were like both like, should we have a beer? And we spent what was it 3 hours? Was it 3 hours? We just sat drinking and chatting.
Oh, it's really funny. It's really funny, Mark.
But okay.
You know,
it's very litigious. I mean, the things we say about Dylan.
No, it's not.
can you release it the day they officially announce the cancellation of Doctor Who?
Okay, I'll say that right now. I will release the untransmitted episode of Mikey and Who when they cancel Doctor Who.
I'm recording an episode on Friday that's timed to go out exactly as the last episode finishes.
Well, let's just do it all. Let's go out in a blaze of glory. But yeah, I'm on X at Mikey Smith UK. I'm a actor, presenter, director of no repute.
Better to have no repute than ill repute, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
True. It's true. Mm.
God, I'm too pissed to say his name. what's his fucking name? Mike Yates.
Oh, Richard Franklin.
Richard Franklin.
Let's go back on that. Don't bring Richard Franklin into this, Dylan.
Oh, also, if you're listening to this going, man, I've got some niche Doctor Who interests that really need to be explored. Dylan, Mike and I took part in Too Hot for TV's, what was it, the 5th anniversary special?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
In which we did a live table read of Richard Franklin, who we've discussed at length in this story. his 1984 fringe show, Recall Unit, The Great Teabag Mystery. And we got mentioned on, was it Cult Box?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were almost
That's
legit.
How good we fucking are.
We were next to David Tennant's podcast.
Exactly.
Do we know anyone that saw the fringe show?
Liam Rodden was in it. That's the only person I tangentially know.
Yeah, we need to find someone, don't we? That's the kind of thing I would have done on Mikey and Who, isn't it? Find someone who watched it. And
You know what we need to do? We need to, you know, like they did that Who's Doctor Who, bringing all the people back together.
Yeah.
We need to do that, but for Richard Franklin's Bow Wow's, his fan club.
And they're all shaking. Just like clutching themselves.
Do you remember that really terrible Doctor Who live that they did with One Direction?
Yeah.
We need to do that.
It's so funny. Like, I saw the other day...
Bring on the Backstreet Boys and ask them what they think of the Great Teabag Mystery.
I saw someone the other day saying, why doesn't Star Trek get the same sort of attention to detail in its kind of surrounding materials as Doctor Who? And in one sense, I was like, you do have a point, but in the other sense, it's like, there's nothing in Star Trek to match the Great Teabag Mystery. Like,
Star Trek's very professional, isn't it? Even in its kind of spin-off media and sort of fan productions. Everything's very polished.
I know, it's taken them about, how many years has it taken them to put that fucking Cannes radio play together?
We would have had about
15
Christ.
Of them in the last
year
with Big Finish.
Yeah. Doctor Who churn out 20 radio plays a month.
Yeah.
Can't. We'd have had fucking Nero, fucking the other cunts. I'm quite drunk, so I can't remember my Star Trek villains, but you know what I mean.
What about the big green hand?
Aye, him as well.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure.
And let's do it again sometime.
Anybody listening to this podcast, going, Richie's our trusted guide to classic Doctor Who.
What's happening?
It's a sham. It's a fucking sham.
I know.
Burn this podcast to the ground. We'll start again.
Yeah. You better keep this bit in.
I feel like we're ending on a sour note where we're just bullying this guy.
Yeah.
Over what DVDs he has and hasn't got.
We've all had a lovely time.
Okay. I mean, I may have just faded it off at this point. So
I think that's probably wise.
But this is the show. This is the show, Richie.